For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's interview comes from the Morning Show archives. It was initially recorded and broadcast back in 2010. Again, the term lobbyist and lobbying. And it's something that most of us have at least some notion about, but we, I think, have a very sketchy idea of the history behind lobbyists and lobbying at the highest levels of government. And I have so enjoyed and learned so much from a fascinating new book called King of the Lobby, The Life and Times of Sam Ward, Man About Washington in the Gilded Age. This is a book which gives us a very rich historical context to the modern-day lobbyist by showing us someone who was especially good at lobbying in the post-war era, that is, the era immediately following the Civil War. And this book helps us understand the ways in which the United States itself was different at that time, how the government itself and its role utterly transformed by the war, and that how in the midst of this highly charged, turbulent era, someone like Sam Ward could end up being the king of all lobbyists in many respects. It's a really interesting look back, and it makes you stop and think about the whole notion of lobbying and the ways in which that might be something of a benefit for us as a country, and of course all the ways in which it is a very counterproductive, kind of ominous present in American political life. The book, again, is called King of the Lobby, The Life and Times of Sam Ward, Man About Washington in the Gilded Age. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. The author, Catherine Alamong Jacob, curator of the manuscripts at the Schlesinger Library on the History of Women in America at the Ratliff Institute, housed at Harvard University. Before this, she's written Testament to Union, Civil War Monuments in Washington, D.C., and Capital Elites, High Society in Washington, D.C., after the Civil War. Catherine Alamong Jacob, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much.
At least one of those books helps point us to your fascination with the topic of this particular book, Mr. Sam Ward. Maybe you could help us understand, though, how we get from your work as curator of manuscripts at the Schlesinger Library to producing books like this. I mean, I suspect that's an interesting connection.
Well, I'm a historian of the post-Civil War era, which helps me a great deal as I seek to increase our collections. The post-Civil War era, in addition to being a very interesting one in Washington, is the era of the suffrage movement, reform movements of many kinds that involved women. So there is a tie-in. Plus, we have some collections at the library that helped me very much with this book, and the main one is the Julia Ward Howe collection. Julia Ward Howe was Sam Ward's sister. She's infinitely respectable, was horrified at her brother's profession, but loved him very much. And her papers are at the Schlesinger Library and were a great help with lots of letters between the two and other family members.
We should mention, although I'm sure that name is quite familiar to many people, that what is her most lasting fame is her authorship of the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
That's right.
And that says probably a lot about who she was and what was important to her.
That's right. She and her husband, Samuel Gridley Howe, were ardent abolitionists, which put them at odds with Sam for a time. He was certainly a supporter of the Union, but he believed in gradual emancipation, compensation for slave owners. So there was a period during the early 1860s when they were definitely estranged.
We're talking about a figure, Sam Ward, who in his heyday was the most admired and most successful of Washington lobbyists. I think one of the things that is astonishing about his story is that he suffered so many reversals through the course of his life before coming to Washington.
Yes.
I mean, it's a very checkered past.
It certainly is.
Sketch some of that for us.
And I think that's one of the reasons he's such an interesting character. He has enormous strengths and he has enormous weaknesses. And one of his weaknesses was with managing money. He earned and lost several fortunes, some by gullibility, some by reckless speculation. He thought he knew more than he did. It would have been, charming as he is, and much as I've enjoyed his company, I think he would have been extremely frustrating to be married to be related to be dependent upon. He was like the grasshopper when other people were the ants storing away their money. Sam lived very well, but with other men's money, and whenever he had any of his own, he gave it away in lavish presents to friends and family and to complete strangers.
He had a very interesting background growing up in a fascinating household, and at some point seemed to pick up a great interest in other people and in particular other cultures. And I suppose that was something that made him uncommon and which served him well in what he would ultimately explore.
Yes, you're absolutely right. He's not the black sheep of his family, but he's certainly a different personality than his siblings, than his very conservative father. His father was very concerned about the moral upbringing of his children, tried to shelter them a great deal. And it somehow didn't take with Sam. He went off to Europe. He somehow convinced his father to let him go study in Europe before coming back to enter the banking firm. And that really broadened his horizons. When he was an undergraduate at Columbia, he learned a little more about the world. But when he went to Paris and then Germany to study and stayed for a total of almost 4 years, it transformed his life. He came back, as his father feared he would, with new ideas. He knew new songs, he knew new dances, he had met new people. But it was really his ideas about the importance of society and gracious living and entertaining that would stand him in good stead the rest of his life, but put him at odds with his father.
One of the things you mentioned about Sam Ward is at a point in time when, this is actually early in his schooling at a place called Round Hill, you say Sam revealed a talent for friendship. That's an interesting choice of words. What do you mean by that?
I think Sam was a very sympathetic ear. Everyone described him as a wonderful listener. He took seriously the concerns that other people shared with him. He opened his heart to them, and I think that was reciprocated. He made friends even as a young child. He was only about 10 and 11 and 12 when he was at Round Hill. But he made friends that lasted his whole life, friends in the North and in the South, friends who would become eventually very important to him in positions of power in Washington. But he gathered people to him. He had a magnetic personality, and his sympathy for other people's stories, I think, was compelling.
Well, nevertheless, despite kind of a personal elegance and interest in other people and charm and intelligence, he had all kinds of problems. You write at one point, the road that led him to Washington was full of detours that included love, loss, fortunes won and lost, exile, and aliases. You tell us in particular about a bewildering, heartbreaking series of personal losses, which he sustained one right after another, which probably would have sent some people off the deep end, and which he somehow managed to survive.
That's right. It would have been a series of crushing losses to most people, and it did take Sam a little while to recover, but I think his optimism and his forward-looking personality enabled him to come back. He lost his wife, Emily, who he loved dearly. He lost his infant son. He lost his brother, his father, and then Nathaniel Prime, who'd been the founder of the banking firm Prime, Ward & King, that Sam's father was the ward of Prime, Ward & King. Nathaniel Prime had been a mentor to Sam, and as he aged, he had delusions that he lost all his money and he slit his throat with a razor. And that was sort of the last of a string of terrible losses to Sam. He found himself 27 years old, a widower with a child. He was responsible for the three of his sisters. And he was now he was the ward at Prime, Ward & King.
Ultimately, one of the first indications we have of who he was ultimately to become came when he was able to finagle his way, that's your term, into a diplomatic mission to the nation of Paraguay.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this connection to Paraguay and its president or prime minister and the kind of work that he did and the sort of precursor that it represents for what he eventually would do in Washington.
Well, he had made a fortune and lost a fortune in San Francisco. He was kicking around looking for something to do. He was on secret missions doing, we're not sure what, to France, to South America. And then a man that he met on the ship going with the 49ers to California, William Gwynn, helped him land a position with this U.S. diplomatic mission to Paraguay. The mission was to settle disputes between Paraguay and the United States regarding trade and an incident in which the Paraguayan military had fired upon a U.S. Naval ship. So Sam turns out to be the only person in the whole delegation who could speak Spanish, so he was an asset. And he claimed credit, and nobody disputed this, for the happy turn of events. They weren't there very long before all of the issues were pretty much settled. Sam had a wonderful time. He wrote about the women he saw and the food that he ate and the dances he learned. He perfected his guitar playing. And behind the back of the head of the U.S. mission, he negotiates a private contract with the president of Paraguay, President Lopez, to lobby for the government of Paraguay in Washington. They had hammered out parts of a treaty and a settlement, but that had to be worked through the Congress. So he comes back with, I think, 10,000 pounds in silver, and a set for making mate, a drink of South America, and he pops up in Washington in 1859.
One of the most intriguing things about Sam Ward's life, which is really ahead of his lobbying days, but so intriguing, is the work that he did during the Civil War as something of a go-between between the government of the North and the government of Jefferson Davis. Could you tell us a little bit about this work that he was doing? It seems like something, that reads more like fiction than nonfiction.
It does. It's a very interesting chapter in his life, and one that's not very well known, hasn't been written about very much. I'm very interested in trying to flesh it out a little more. Sam had already begun giving the dinners that would make him famous in his house in Washington, where he would bring together his clients and members of the cabinet or members of Congress that had a relationship to whatever the topic was. So his house provided the perfect cover for men of the North, men of the South, who were trying to reach a compromise, trying to find a settlement in the days before war actually broke out. And the two men who were chiefly involved was the new Secretary of State, William Seward, who Sam knew from New York politics. He was a Republican, Sam was a Democrat, but they were friends and knew one another and respected one another. And the other was William Gwynne, the man he'd met on the ship going to California to be one of the gold miners, who was a lifelong friend and Southerner, slave owner from Mississippi. And so the two of them would use Sam's dining room as a neutral meeting ground. Then when war does come, Sam, another of Sam's friends, and he had lots of interesting ones, is William Russell, who's known as the first war correspondent. He was a British journalist who had covered the Crimean War, and his editor couldn't believe these stories from the United States, that there might actually be a division in the country. So he sends Russell here. Russell looks up Sam. Sam has lots of relatives and friends through the South. So the two of them head off on a tour through the South. They go, they're in Charleston days after Fort Sumter's fired upon. They go down through the South, through Louisiana, through Alabama, and eventually come up through Mississippi. And the whole time, Sam is using Russell's dispatch pouch to send letters written with a pseudonym back to Seward, but he sends them to one of Seward's employees at the State Department. And they're filled with the most useful information about batteries that he sees being built along the rivers, the number of boats and what kind, and with what they're armed in the harbors. He talks about a lack of gunpowder. He reports conversations among very highly placed people in the Confederacy. So, I mean, he certainly would have been shot or hung had he been found out, but he wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you write at one point, for Sam to send reports from deep inside the Confederacy back to the Secretary of State in Washington was a tricky business all around. I mean, and Seward was risking great embarrassment, and of course Sam Ward was risking far more than embarrassment.
Right.
One of the things that is intriguing about this story, he explains at one point to Seward how, this is Sam Ward explaining how he was able to find out as much information as he was. You tell us he explained to Seward that his method of gleaning was to evince no curiosity when told the most incredible things.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that gift for managing a sort of a deadpan look, even while taking in, you know, maybe information of extraordinary importance to the North, would have been key to what he was able to do.
Mm-hmm. After he comes back through from this swing through the South, he goes to New York and checks into the New York Hotel, which is a hotbed of Southern sympathy, both for Southerners who happened to be caught in the North and for Copperhead Democrats. Those were Democrats who supported the Confederacy or who didn't support the war. And Sam would go to the bar. He'd listen to everything that was being said. He'd engage in conversations. And he would send this all back to Seward in letters. Some of them are very long. They're very interesting. And he was a wonderful writer, so they're also a pleasure to read.
One of the things that ultimately was of great frustration to Sam Ward is that he needed the work he was doing to lead to a real job.
Mm-hmm.
And he was incessant in asking for this and never received hardly much of even a reply. I mean, even the answer no would have probably been better than sort of the silence that greeted these increasingly desperate entreaties from him to Seward.
He was kept dangling, and he was very naive, I think, to think that Seward could bestow an ambassadorship upon him. He was a Democrat, and Seward and the whole administration were ardent Republicans. And so as useful as Sam had been, Seward never made any promises, and Seward really was in no position to take a job like this that would have been a plum for any Republican, and to turn it over to this Democrat. And then when there would have been an investigation or at least questioning in the press, to have it come out that Seward had been relying on this Democrat who had been traveling through the South and to me and to others who would look at this now, it was clear that that wasn't going to work out. But poor Sam really had high hopes.
Ultimately, he makes his way back to Washington because, in his words, he's got to get some money.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell us that Sam Ward's timing was perfect, that, in fact, he was returning to Washington at a time when it was an utterly transformed city. And more than that, our country and our federal government was also utterly transformed. Let's talk, first of all, about how the United States itself, in this period immediately after the Civil War, was a transformed nation.
Well, to run a war, to supply all those troops, to keep the ports open in the North, to keep the government running on such a grand scale and to extend its reach so far into the South took enormous effort and increased the reach of the federal government into everyday lives in ways that it had never extended before. Much of what was going on after the war was a continuation of trends that had been going on before the war: immigration, Western expansion, industrialization. But the war was really a catalyst for schooling so many people in the idea that the federal government could transform lives. And the federal government, by many, was seen to have ended slavery. If it could do that, what else could it do? So there was an understanding, especially among the young intelligentsia, Henry Adams, William Henry Dana, others of the time, that there was an incredible optimism and a thought that they could change the world, they could change the nation, they could change the direction, that the Union, which had been redeemed by so much blood, was on the verge of a whole new era. But by the same token, it not only held out tremendous promise for good and change, but tremendous prospect for making men millionaires by the other aspects of the federal government, which had changed. There were contracts to be let for all sorts of things as the government expanded west and as the new settlements requested internal improvements. There were canals, there were railroads, there were courthouses to be built, there were new postmasterships to be handed out. So the reach of the federal government was just extending. The explosion in the number of cabinet offices, the Department of Agriculture, several other cabinet positions, the number of congressmen was expanding as settlement increased. Before the Civil War, the federal government had little touch on people's everyday lives, except when their mail was delivered. There wasn't a lot of everyday thought of the federal government. After the war, there are pensions, which it's hard to discount how great the reach of pensions were for Union soldiers. And there were contracts for everything from beef to boots for the army that moved west when they would be fighting Indians on the prairies. It was a very different place.
You write this actually in the introduction to the book. These were years during which the federal government and the nation were undergoing profound changes, and these transformations were the truly big story of the era. I mean, that more than the corruption about which we hear so much.
Right.
The period of transition from a pre-war federal government that was relatively invisible in everyday life to a strong post-war federal government with broad new powers reaching into its citizens' lives was extremely rocky. While these changes were underway, conditions were ripe for the rise of all sorts of mechanisms, among them the lobby, to cope with these unsettled times. Maybe you could talk for a moment about the city of Washington, D.C. itself, which also was utterly transformed in this period right after the war. Maybe say a little bit about what one saw in Washington, D.C. in the 1850s, versus the late 60s and into the 70s. I mean, what kind of changes had taken place, and beyond the obvious cosmetic transformation, what did it say about the changing face of America and its government?
Well, in many ways, the changes in Washington mirror the change in the government. Before the war, Washington was a small town. Foreign diplomats complained bitterly about this outpost on the Potomac. It was small, it was dirty, it was sparsely populated, few buildings that were grand. There was the White House, there was the Capitol, and then a few other buildings joined them, the Smithsonian, the old Castle Building, the Treasury. But they were really marooned on islands with very little in between. The streets weren't paved. There were livestock in the streets. There was a very poor sanitation system. And it bespoke the smallness of the federal government. When congressmen would come, they would rarely bring their families because there wasn't much to do and there weren't many decent places to live. They would come, people liken it to a flock of all-male migratory birds that would alight on the Potomac for the winter and then disperse. After the war, the terms of Congress extend, there's much more business to be conducted, members of Congress need to stay longer, and the city has been transformed. First, it's a mess, and the war left it with no trees and carcasses of dead mules, and it really was a mess. But when there was a move to move the Capitol out of Washington, because it wasn't very centrally located and it had been on the border of the North and South, the people of Washington decide, oh my goodness, if the Capitol moves, there'll be nothing here. It had no other reason to exist. So they planned the new Washington, and it was to be a beautiful city with wide streets and lovely trees. And it mirrored the new federal government. Men start to come to Washington for the longer sessions of Congress. They bring their wives. They build houses. They rent houses. And a society, a high society, becomes more regularized. There's the social season. That's a very interesting one. And when foreigners see that it's interesting, they bring their wives. And then when there's things to be gotten from this federal government, wealthy men from all around the country decide it's worth spending the winter in Washington. This is a little bit later, but people like Westinghouse, Pullman, Alexander Graham Bell, they have magnificent homes in Washington and use it to lobby for the things they need to further their business interests.
Hmm. One thing you mentioned about Washington that I think it would be so easy for us to overlook or certainly take for granted is the fact that it was a very different city from other cities that had been established for longer periods of time, like Boston or or New York City, in that you say there was an absence of a large homegrown elite. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that was a vacuum which could be filled.
That's right. There was a very small local elite. Washington had not been much of a town before it was chosen as the site of the federal government. So there weren't these old families that had established either farms or plantations or businesses for decades. So when the federal government shows up in 1800, this is a town without a large local base. Its raison d'etre is to be the home of the federal government and really nothing else. So there's no Cerberus to guard the door to society like there is in Boston that has its Cabots and Lodges and Philadelphia with Cadwaladers. There is no old elite to guard the doors. And it's clear to the nouveau riche after the war that the doors are wide open in Washington, and money talks. And it talks more loudly than it does in the old established cities.
We're speaking with Catherine Alamong Jacob, and we're talking about her book, King of the Lobby, The Life and Times of Sam Ward, Man About Washington in the Gilded Age. So explain how Sam Ward is able to sort of enter the arena of Washington, D.C. It is, in a sense, at the behest of someone by the name of Hugh McCulloch.
Yes, he's the Secretary of the Treasury under Andrew Johnson. And he has a Herculean task of transforming the currency of the country from a wartime currency that was wildly inflated back to a currency based on gold bullion. This is not easy. McCulloch knows that. And he turns to Sam, who he's known. Sam, even though he hadn't been very good at it, Sam speaks the talk of finance. So he knows the language, and he knows some of the principal players, and he brings them together over dinner at his home, financed by the Secretary of the Treasury, and enables people to talk over the issues. Now, McCulloch doesn't get everything that he wants, and before too long, he loses even the small gains that he achieved. But he's not dissatisfied with Sam. He credits Sam with the small advances he was able to make. Sam, who is very good at self-promotion, takes McCulloch's praise and lets it be known that he had been of enormous help to the Secretary of the Treasury, and other clients begin to gravitate to Sam. He represents Baring Brothers, the big British banking house. He represents manufacturing interests, shipping interests, mining interests, people with claims against the government. He parlays both his lobbying for Paraguay and for McCulloch into a very, very lucrative and successful lobby practice.
One thing that is intriguing and frustrating is that he did not leave behind him very much in the way of written legacy about exactly how he lobbied, or many of the specifics about what he did and with whom and for whom and so on. You say there are hints, and in some ways he left behind more hints than a lot of lobbyists did about their respective practices. First of all, maybe you could say just a word about why lobbying then, and I suppose to some extent even now, is shrouded in some secrecy. And the little that we do know about Sam Ward, how we know what we know.
Well, we do know more about how Sam Ward operated than we do about most Gilded Age lobbyists. And one of the reasons is because Sam was such an articulate letter writer, and many of his clients and friends would write to him, and they saved his letters. Now, it's true that we don't have much evidence in Sam's own writing, but that's not because he didn't save it. It's because his sister Julia destroyed it. There are notes in the Schlesinger Library collection, actually, about 7 trunks full of Sam's papers. I don't know who his handwriting it is. It doesn't appear to be Julia's or any of her daughter's. But it talks at length about the richness of the material in these trunks. And then there's a letter a little later on from one of Julia's daughters that talks about Julia burning the contents of all of Sam's trunks upon his death. It's possible he asked her to do that. It's also possible that Julia, who had never reconciled to Sam's career, decided that this was for the best. But in Sam's correspondence with his chief client, Samuel Barlow, a millionaire New Yorker, there is extremely candid information. Barlow will write to Sam about a bill he once passed. He's very explicit, I want this passed, and it's in this subcommittee, and I expect it to come up at a certain date. And Sam will write back and say, okay, it will cost you X number of dollars for his fee and X number of dinners, and he'll name a fee for the dinners. And he and Barlow together will decide on the guest list, and it will be the key members of the various House and Senate committees involved in whatever the issue is. And then Sam will report, X number of people came to dinner last night, this is what I learned, this is how so-and-so is leaning, this is how another congressman is leaning, this is the tack I think we need to take. So that they are very candid, and they're a wonderful window onto the era. Another good collection of letters is the diary of James Garfield, who was a member of the House before he was president. And he and Sam are good friends. They're brought together by the classics. They both love the Greek and Roman classics. And Garfield is often alone in Washington. His wife and children are back in Ohio. He loves going to dinner at Sam's. It's wonderful conversation, wonderful food. He's no fool. He knows that there's a reason he's there. But he writes down in his diary every time he goes to Sam's and who is around the table. And all you have to do is look up those men and find out what committee assignments they had or what interests they represented. And you can see how Sam operated.
One of the ways in which he described what he did is it was corralling congressional elephants.
Mm-hmm.
and of course, he brought all kinds of different gifts to bear. You tell us that one of the things that, of course, he was renowned for was his magnificent flair for entertaining,
mm-hmm.
and particularly for his skill as a chef. You call his kitchen something of a laboratory,
mm-hmm.
and where he came up with all kinds of incredible things. But I think it would be especially important to acknowledge the way in which the whole notion of the culinary arts and what we ate as Americans was changing tremendously at this point in our history. Say a word about that, please.
Well, the years after the Civil War, and to some extent the war itself, did change much about America and much about what was eaten, particularly on the East Coast. But there were changes in shipping and in refrigeration on ships with blocks of ice, in faster shipping, and that meant that things like bananas and pineapples could be transported to East Coast ports from South America without spoiling. There were changes in canning, which meant that perishable things like peaches and tomatoes could be canned and sent for long distances with more train tracks and more access to grazing lands in the West and also to farms up and down the East Coast. It was easier and faster to take meat to market. So, and there were changes in things like baking powder, and changes in the way that flour was ground. So even baked goods were changing. You could use baking powder for leavening. The flour was finer. It gave a much more delicate texture to baked goods. So you could have fluffy layer cakes. You could have all sorts of things like lettuce, which doesn't keep very long and wilts easily. You can transport lettuce up and down the East Coast from farms on the inland. So what's served is changing, and as more influences from Europe trickle in and there's a larger and wealthier upper class, there are changes in the way food is served and the idea that dinners are later. You have the first restaurants in America. Delmonico's in New York is usually considered to be the first real restaurant where there's a menu and where there are things like tablecloths. And the idea of not eating in your home, of having a fine meal outside of your home that's not a big banquet for a special occasion is something very new. And things like how elegant meals were served. It used to be service American, which meant that all the dishes were put out on the table and you helped yourself to whatever you wanted. But you knew what the whole meal was going to consist of. And that changes in the years after the war more and more to service a la Russian service. That meant that courses were served one at a time, that staff would bring out a platter that was the first course or serve the soup, and that would be taken away, and then the next course would come out, which is it doesn't seem like that much of a change to us, but it was a change, and lots of people commented on it. A man named Philip Hone in New York, who was a wonderful diary keeper, was incensed. He complained constantly about this new kind of service. He didn't know what was coming next or how much was coming or what it would be, so he didn't know how much to eat of each course. And his diary entries are really very funny, but it shows that even something like that can cause great upheaval. So there was a lot of change in the way Americans were eating and in what they were eating.
You tell us that not only did Sam Ward love this, I mean, he was tremendously interested in food and, mm-hmm. and cooking and the latest techniques and so on, but that he, who happened to be an amateur poet as well and a published poet, actually set some of his recipes into rhymed verse. You must have had such fun looking through
these. Oh, it was great. One of the New York newspapers carried Uncle Sam's Culinary Rhymes, I think the column was called. The one that I remember most best is, to roast spring chickens is to spoil them, split them up the back and broil them. He did love puttering in the kitchen. He had his own chef at his own home, and he had a butler, Jerry, who was an Irishman who was Sam's eyes and ears all around town. But he also entertained in restaurants. He would have some of his larger lobby dinners for 10 to 14 people in a restaurant called Welker's in Washington that he favored. And he would work with the chef there to design the perfect dinner for the occasion.
One thing that I find quite intriguing is the whole notion of exactly who should be invited to a given event and who should sit next to who. And I think you do a great job of laying out for us just what a complicated and important matter this was. This is what you write. In composing his guest list, Sam considered which members' constituents would howl if they voted for or against certain measures and whose had little stake in certain issues, and he would court the latter. Everything Sam knew or could find out about potentially important players involved with the issues he followed came into play. Which members were alone in Washington and lonely? Who was most persuasive? And who was most easily persuaded? Who was leaning one way and who another? Who might like to sit next to whom? All of these factors went into the mix when selecting guests. I mean, this is when we really get a sense for what an art and science both this kind of lobbying really was.
Mm-hmm.
And it fills us with maybe a deeper sort of appreciation for what Sam Ward managed to accomplish in being so good at it.
Mm-hmm. There was nothing casual or serendipitous about Sam's dinners. He thought very carefully about what to serve. He didn't want people to go away feeling full. He thought carefully about the size of the portions so they would go away thinking that was a wonderful dinner, but not feeling like, oh, I'm so full, I couldn't eat another bite. One of his guests referred to dinners at Sam's as the climax of civilization. And another referred to them as ambrosial nights, and people, these were very memorable occasions. And so he not only thought about the food and the courses and the size of the portions, he thought about who would be at the table and where they would sit, and he also thought about the conversations. He used anecdotes from his past like condiments at his table. He salted dinners with stories from the gold rush, with stories from his adventures in South America. But he chose them very carefully so that he could lead the conversation in the direction in which he hoped it would go.
He apparently, known as King of the Lobby, would refer to himself sometime as Rex Vestieri.
Mm-hmm.
And but there really came the day when lobbyists were viewed with great disdain by much of the public, and you say that they were really a convenient scapegoat, and probably to some extent maybe even a deserving scapegoat for some of the ills that rocked the nation, particularly during the 1870s. How did Sam Ward ride those turbulent rapids when the idea of lobbyists became so distasteful to so many Americans? Did that make a very big difference to him and into his livelihood?
It didn't make a difference in his livelihood. It's remarkable that Sam reigned unspotted during this time. He was never, no charges ever stuck to Sam of any ill methods. He never was charged with bribery, with blackmail. He traded in information and in bringing people together. But this, you're right, this is at a time when the lobby was reviled. It was the whipping boy of the press. A lot seemed to be going wrong with the United States. There was scandal after scandal during the second Grant administration. And the scandal reached into the cabinet. Belknap resigned. It reached into the White House right outside the secretary's door in the whiskey ring with his assistant being implicated. There was the Credit Mobilier scandal, which entrapped lots of congressmen who had taken stock in this front for the railroads. And it looked like the government was going to hell in a handbasket. And this is only a few years after the Civil War, which had cost thousands of lives. And how could this be? This was so troubling. This is also a period when the press is becoming more powerful. So this is sensationalized, and they're looking for someone to blame it on. And the lobby is very convenient because the lobby is implicated in some of these scandals. And it seems to be a subverting of the government, of the people's will. Now, what was forgotten and rarely mentioned is that lobbying is protected by the First Amendment. This is something that the Founding Fathers thought of, redress of grievances, right to petition. So it's very hard to condemn the lobby and to call for it to be abolished and still be true to the Constitution and allow for people to petition for out of self-interest. So it is remarkable that Sam is not tarred with that same brush. The term king of the lobby is never used, that I've been able to find, as a term of derision. It's not a sneer to say that he's king of the lobby. It's a remarkable feat that he pulls off. Sam is very well connected, and the fact that he's very upfront about what he does, I think, deflects some of the criticism. He never denies that he brings people together, and that his dinners are funded by clients with axes to grind. He makes no bones about it. This is his profession. He feels he's doing an honorable job, and he's upfront about it.
And he takes pride in the fact that, as far as we can tell, he never took a bribe, offered a bribe, engaged in blackmail, mm-hmm. or engaged in any of those kind of practices, which, of course, are questionable and even illegal. I mean, he did this work as honorably as he could.
I think that's right. He never claimed that this was the most honorable profession one could have, but he was proud of the fact that he made it as honorable as he could.
The book is called King of the Lobby, The Life and Times of Sam Ward, Man About Washington in the Gilded Age. It is published by Johns Hopkins University Press, and its author, Catherine Alamong Jacob. Catherine Alamong Jacob, I really learned so much from reading your book, and it was fun to talk with you as well about your very interesting book. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview I'm very excited to share with you about the world of music. My guest, Jeremy Denk, a recent guest of Terry Gross on Fresh Air. His memoir about his life growing up as an aspiring pianist. He is now one of the world's finest concert pianists. Is called Every Good Boy Does Fine, A Love Story in Music Lessons. In the book, he gives disarmingly honest portraits of the array of teachers with which he has studied over the course of his life, and also some of the